is Bad Boys and Beyond with your hosts, Mike Payton and Keith Black Trudeau.
That's it, baby, I'm foul.
Hey, I'll put it in the front page, back page, middle page, wherever headliners, column one or two, we will win game two. Good back it off, we will win game two.
The game's over and the Pistons have won the world championship.
Welcome back to Bad Boys and Beyond. We're your hosts, Mike Payton, Keith Black Trudeau. Normally we're coming in here a lot more hot. We're coming in a lot more excited. But something happened yesterday, Keith. What was that? What happened to the Pistons yesterday?
So the Detroit Pistons set a little bit of franchise history. Last night, they lost their 15th consecutive game, which is something the Detroit Pistons, or the Pistons in general, as a franchise, and their 75-year relationship with the NBA. Keep in mind, as a franchise, they're about 90 years old, or as a club, they're about 90 years old. But there are no individual game records prior to that. So we're just going to stop at the 1940s. In any case, the Pistons have never lost 15 games in a row in the middle of a season. Now, there is one stretch between 1980 and 1981 where they lost 21 straight, but that involved the last 14 of the 1980 season plus the first seven of the 80-81 season. But in the middle of a season, this is a first in Pistons history. This is a new mark in futility for a team, which this wouldn't hurt nearly as much as if we weren't already in year four of this current rebuild. Under this current management regime. Mike, I know you have more strong feelings on this than I, because this is just something that I think I've seen coming for a couple of weeks now. And at this point, me personally, I'm just kind of numb to this. It feels a lot to me like I'm watching the 2008 Detroit Lions all over again. And this team is clearly hopeless, and I'm just waiting for someone to get fired so we can have someone new to take over and start this all over again, which is depressing enough. But I guess I just don't have enough energy left to be angry. Maybe it's my old age.
Oh, Keith, here's the thing. I have been a Detroit sports fan my entire life, just like you have. Born in 1985. You know, something about Detroit sports, you're pushed into it by your family members. You know, maybe it's the same for everybody, but for us, it was just like handed down to us. Here you go. You're a Pistons fan. You're a Lions fan, Tigers, Red Wings. About 1989, 1990, 1991, something like that. I don't remember exactly what year it was. I was handed a videotape, a VHS tape, some of you younger listeners, I know we don't have a whole lot of them. They probably don't know what I'm talking about, but I was handed a VHS tape as a present by my Uncle Jim, and it was called Bad Boys. It was all about the 1988 Detroit Pistons. This tape for me, it was everything. You know, I know kids, I don't have kids, but I know that a lot of kids have a habit of putting in a video, maybe Frozen or whatever, and watching it over and over and over and over and over and over again. For me, it was this 1988 Detroit Pistons tape. This started my love of sports. This started my love of the Detroit Pistons. This started my basketball card collection. This started everything for me. All the posters are on my wall of Grant Hill and Isaiah Thomas and the Bulls, Michael Jordan, all that comes from just watching this tape. So for me, the Pistons have always been the one team that I refused to be negative about. You know, I spend my career being impartial about the Lions, or trying to be impartial about the Lions, and the Red Wings, I'm okay with saying, hey, they suck sometimes. They're doing well right now. Tigers are on the longest rebuild of my lifetime, and I'm okay with saying that. But for the Pistons, I just refused for the longest time to be negative. And even last week, I came on this show And I talked about how I wasn't quite ready to do it yet because, you know, James Edwards of The Athletic had talked to me, and we kind of came to the understanding that, look, they just aren't healthy and they're just not ready yet and blah, blah, blah. For like basically the first time in my life, I'm done. I'm done with that. I'm fucking done with that. Because 15 games in a row is no easy feat. It's not easy to lose 15 games in a row. You have to try really hard. You have to work together as a team, as an organization, a front office. Everyone needs to come together, down to the guys selling the beer in the stands, to lose 15 straight games. It's very hard to do. And yet here we are. I am looking at this organization, this Detroit Pistons team, that has lost 15 games in a row, and stacking that on top of several years, including last year, which was the worst year in franchise history, which feels like it's on its way to being beat. But you stack that on top of years of futility. Now, we haven't been good since, 2009, 2010? When was the last time we were in the Eastern Conference Finals?
The last time I took up permanent residence in the greater Detroit area, Metro Detroit, 2007-2008. I believe it was the third best record in franchise history. I think they went 59-23 and got to the conference finals and lost to the only team with a better record than they had, which in the Boston Celtics. I know, because I was there in the game that they were eliminated, game six. And that just wasn't good enough for everybody. Everybody wanted a championship. Going to the conference finals, they got stale every year. And believe me, I have not forgotten, and I will never forget the treatment that that team received from the local media, specifically sports radio. Certain people who are still on the air today, who just ripped them every single opportunity. A team that won 59-23 because they were boring. They were stale. They didn't have any young first-round picks to develop. This team's never going to win another championship. Why didn't you break it up years ago? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now we have flash forward 15 years. Here we are today. They have not tasted any success of any note since. They've made the playoffs three times and gotten swept all three times. So in addition to having a long playoff drought, they also, I believe, hold one of the all-time longest records for most consecutive playoff games lost, because every time they make the playoffs, they sneak in as a number eight seed and they get obliterated in the first round. So even the years you would call success since 2008 have been absolute failures. I really don't have much else to add to this long, long streak of futility. And to be honest with you, I feel bad for all the younger fans, because I've always considered myself blessed, because I've experienced three NBA championships from a market that anyone would consider not a premier NBA basketball market. There are so many other more successful franchises all time than the Detroit Pistons, a lot. The Pistons all time have one of the losingest winning percentages of any franchise, and yet they have three championships, whereas any number of franchises either don't have any or they haven't won any since the 1970s.
The Wizards, perfect example of
Wizards, yeah. The Knicks, the Pacers, even if you want to include their ABA championship. If you look up the winningest franchises by percentage, the Jazz and the Blazers are both up there. They have combined for exactly one NBA championship in their histories combined. And they win just about every year. They're in the playoffs just about every year, maybe not this year. But they have had incredible runs of success, and they never, aside from one freak year where Bill Walton managed to stay healthy, neither of them have ever gotten over the hump. Pistons got over the hump three times. The Pistons were giant killers. They were the one small market team that punched above their weight until the Spurs came along. Just to see this massive fall from grace is just – and a lot of people will blame Tom Gores for this, and I totally get it. I blame him too.
Hold on, Keith. Hold on. Let me finish cooking here, because I need to.
I'm sorry. My co-host was not done cooking. I apologize. I didn't realize he wasn't done yet.
Before you address Tom Gores, I need to address Tom Gores.
Okay.
As my co-host so eloquently put it, 15 years, if I were to, if I had a child the last year that this team was good, it would be in high school now. So I am looking at this owner right now in this front office. And you know what I feel today, Keith? I feel like I'm held hostage because I can't do anything about it.
I don't blame you.
No one can do anything about it. And I'm looking at an owner who has displayed to me time and again that he does not care, that this is a cash cow for him. He's a billionaire who wants to become a trillionaire, and he's never going to be one. But the point being that this is just an ATM. This is just an ATM that he could just take money out of. He'll show up every now and then. He'll get drunk in the crowd like an idiot. And he'll dance and all this stupid stuff when they win, but when they're losing, he's nowhere to be found. He has not addressed this fan base not once since this losing streak has begun. I wanted to believe in Troy Weaver just like everybody else did, and I thought for a while that I did, and I thought for a while that this was the right guy to go with, but he is so massively messed up this rebuild, especially in the last year, to not go after anyone in free agency, even though, you look, there's no stars, there's no mega stars out there. There were guys that could have contributed to a better team. To take players and trade them away when they're actually playing well. Look, Jalen Duren is great, but Jeremy Grant is a constant contributor for the Portland Trailblazers. And I'm not saying that the Pistons are a remarkably better team with Jeremy Grant, but you look at it and it's like, okay, well, maybe that wasn't the best idea. Maybe there was another way that we could have tried to have swung Jeremy Grant. But then, you know, a report comes out today that a team was interested in sending 2 first round draft picks. Now, I don't know the validity of this report. Yeah. I do not know the validity of this report because I'm a football writer. I know what's real there, and I don't totally know what's real in basketball.
The source on this one was kind of take it with a grain of salt. Maybe it's okay. True, but I can see where it may be someone just exaggerated.
To me, it seemed a little bit rich for Bojan Bogdanović, but I guess it sort of made sense in the way that teams are looking for a player like Bojan, especially if they're trying to get over that hump. You know, that one extra player that can help you win a championship. But even if it's one first round pick, you know, why are we holding on to this guy? And he supposedly is coming back tonight when the Pistons play the Knicks. When you're listening to this tomorrow, maybe we're looking at a team that has broken the losing streak, or maybe we're looking at a team that's approaching the Philadelphia 76ers record of 28 straight losses. I'm just so mad. I'm so upset. And no, what's worse is that nothing is going to happen. Nothing will be done about this. Maybe a trade in a couple of weeks will appease us, get us to shut our mouths just a little bit. But is that really going to be good enough? Is that really going to actually fix anything? I want a team that's going to win a championship. I want a team that's going to base level make it to the playoffs. You know, I'm tired of cheering for a team that is doing nothing for me but hurting me. And, you know, it's destroying my entire my life. It's destroying my life, Keith. I mean, this is, you know, I go back to when I was a child and getting Pistons tickets, you know, for my stepdad's boss was like a huge thing. It was like, we're going to the game tonight. I can't wait. Like, this is incredible. And now going to a Pistons game is like, it's like going to an execution, man. Like there's barely anybody there. The team on the floor is losing. People in the crowd are drunk. I mean, did you see the Donovan Edwards thing last night? That dude was Not that there's anything wrong with that.
That's not on him. No. Obviously, he is old enough to drink. And
yeah, there's nothing wrong with him. I thought it was funny. Yeah,
he was just having a good time, which is more than I could say about everybody else in that building. I think Johnny Cain maybe needed to get the mic. And look, I think that was the saddest part about the broadcast last night is they were constantly looking for Detroit athletes not working for the Detroit Pistons. Michigan Wolverines, Detroit Lions, all of which, by the way, they were there to see LeBron. They were not there to see the Pistons. Exactly. They were trying to be nice about it, but those guys aren't coming to watching them see the Washington Wizards. I'm sorry. So they tried. We're at the point where the entire Valley Sports Detroit, which, by the way, they're a dumpster fire in themselves. That's not. We're not going to blame the Pistons for that, but
I am. I am. You have a
so
choice.
Hard. They tried so hard not to talk about the Pistons last night. I thought that was the saddest. Just the saddest thing. My final piece on this is going to be this. Tom Gores, I think he certainly cares about his image, or else he wouldn't have spent.
Is that why he's got that Neil Diamond haircut he's been working on for his entire life?
His public image, not his actual image. Or else he wouldn't have spent a bajillion dollars on getting Monty Williams here. He wouldn't be getting into arguments with his GM over who's going to coach if he just didn't care. He has shown over and over again he's willing to spend money, and he's also shown that he's not willing to suffer too much embarrassment as he's canned his last two GMs after their rebuilds failed. So I don't know that nothing's going to come out of this. I know he was sold a plan, a long-term plan of just losing, building teams that couldn't win and getting high draft picks. And this has just spiraled into something that I don't think Troy Weaver can control anymore. Where losing begets more losing begets more losing. And I think there's a good chance that this is beyond Troy Weaver's ability to fix. Now, the unofficial start to the NBA trade season is going to be mid-December. I think December 15th is when teams that sign contracts over the summer can be traded. That's when you're going to see the wheeling and dealing begin, that 2 months between January and February until the trade deadline. And that's when I expect to see Troy Weaver try to do something. Because, look, even if he does, I don't know that that's going to fix this. Like, if the Pistons win tonight in New York, am I going to feel any better about this, the direction of this team? Because they instead of losing 16 in a row, they went 1-15. No. They would have to do something enormous to really turn this thing around and start rattling off a winning streak in order to make up for this big hole that they dug themselves in. I don't see that happening.
The only thing that pisses me off the most, Keith, is that yesterday I said I was done watching this team, and some guy commented on my Twitter and said, okay, I'll see you tomorrow. And you know what the problem with that is, Keith? He's freaking right. And I hate it. I hate it so much.
I was going to just walk away. Same thing, but I didn't want to be that jerk.
I hate that I can't just walk away. I hate it.
So my thing on Tom Gores is this. Look, an owner of a basketball team is not supposed to be an expert on basketball. No owner is, unless you're Michael Jordan, and he was a terrible owner by all stretches of the imagination. Owner's job is to do two things. One, hire the right people to run his franchise, and two, be willing to cut checks. Gores has been good at one and terrible at the other. Ironically, Bill Davidson, the owner that preceded him, was very stingy when it came to handing out contracts to both players and coaches. He was, look it up. He was not happy about going over the luxury tax, even if it meant winning a championship. He had a line that he wouldn't cross. He ran the Pistons like a business. However, he was excellent at hiring management and excellent at recognizing when his management picks weren't working out, and he moved on from them quickly. Tom Gores is the opposite. This is the second time he's hired someone to run his franchise, and I think this is the second time he's failed, in addition to inheriting Joe Dumars and firing him, which I thought was justified after giving him 4 years and a bunch of money to turn it around, and he couldn't do it. I want to leave with this. The Detroit Pistons have had four losing streaks in their history of at least 14 games. First one was 79-80. That was the Jack McCloskey was the GM at that point, but that die had already been cast. He took over midseason. That was really the team that Dick Vitale had pushed to assemble. And he was fired before that losing streak even happened. The second time that happened was 93-94. That was Jack McKinney, the GM, who tried to cobble together one last run to get Bill Laimbeer and Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars motivated again with the Rodman-Sean Elliott deal. That backfired horribly. That team went into the tank towards the end of the season, and McKinney was fired. The other two of the four were in the last three seasons. The other two, 50% of the longest losing streaks in Pistons history have happened under Troy Weaver's watch in the last three seasons. Troy Weaver's been here 4 years and he still has a job. I'm not saying that I want him fired. I'm not saying that I would fire him right now if I were Tom Gores, though I would strongly consider it. I just want to illustrate to everybody just how bad the Pistons have been under his watch and the massive, massive hole that he has dug this franchise into. There's not a lot of big contracts. Great. I'll send you a Christmas card. But he has right now eight players on this team on first-round pick rookie deals. Seven of them he drafted himself. The eighth, James Wiseman, he traded the only draft pick that still isn't on this roster. He traded him for James Wiseman. So I'm counting James Wiseman as a Troy Weaver first-round draft pick. And you've seen the results. Without veterans, they have been absolutely helpless. So with that said, unless you have something to add, Mike.
I'll just finish it off by saying, and my math is really quick here, so maybe I might be off. Pistons are 368 and 780 in Tom Gore's ownership period. 368 wins, 780 losses. 780 losses, Keith.
That's, yeah, they lose more than two out of every three games.
That's,
over a when did he take over? 2010?
2010, 2011.
So over a 13-year period, they've lost two out of every three games.
Yeah. And they
that is shockingly horrible.
Yeah. They have one winning record.
Yeah. One winning record and one 500 record, if my memory serves.
That is correct. Yep. Two playoff bursts, both bounced in the first round with ease. And also 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 head coaches.
I'm sorry, I don't want to make light of this because look, I watch every single Pistons game like everybody else does, like I assume most of our listeners do.
Yeah.
And it stings me, but to be honest with you, they're very painless at this point because you can tell the games are over before halftime. So you kind of get it all out of your system, and then the next two quarters it's just, you know, waiting around to see is anybody going to start to get to a rhythm? Is anybody going to play well going into the next game? And that's really what you're looking for. It's just 30 minutes of garbage time.
Yeah. I mean, they went into the half, 20 down?
Well, they were down, 20 down 20. First quarter, I think, or at 19 or something.
It was bad immediately. It was bad immediately. And I was watching crime TV by the half with my wife, who loves that Investigation Discovery. It's her favorite channel in the whole world. All right. Well, you know, that's all we're going to talk about today on that. I know we went a little bit over what we usually go on with our banter.
It's a special occasion.
It's a special occasion. Maybe, you know, when they win their next game in January, when they play the Spurs, because that's the next beatable team on their schedule. No,
if you notice, the NBA added two games to everybody's schedule this week, and one of them for the Pistons is the Grizzlies.
Yep.
They can beat the Grizzlies if the Grizzlies just decline to show up, which they are prone to do.
You know what's going to happen, Keith. That's Ja Morant's return game. It's probably I'm saying that's what's going to happen, because that's just what happens to the to Detroit.
I was going to say, those games are like 2 weeks. I think it's next week, isn't it?
I'm not sure.
No, I think it's next week.
Here's the full rundown of what they've got. They got the Knicks. They've got the Cavs. That's a loss. They got the Grizzlies on Wednesday, December 6th. That's a potential win. Orlando is the hot Orlando Magic team. They're going to be hard to beat. Indiana, who just put 140 on them last week. The 76ers, twice in a row.
That's two losses.
At one at home, one away. You got the Milwaukee Bucks in their building.
That's another loss.
Atlanta.
Loss.
Utah.
That could be a win. Utah is tanking pretty hard. They are not the Utah of last season.
Okay. You got Brooklyn back-to-back.
Two losses.
The Celtics and then the Toronto Raptors.
Well, least best team.
And that's the end of the year, the year. And then January, we'll see. Houston, Utah, Golden State, Denver, Sacramento, and then San Antonio on the 10th.
Yeah. The Hornets, the Jazz, the Grizzlies, and the Spurs are all beatable. And the Blazers, I know they've already played them once, but the Blazers are beatable.
This is sad. This is sad that we're going through this saying, well, maybe they could beat this team, but they couldn't beat the Wizards. I mean, they lost like by 20 points to what we all considered the worst team in the league.
I'm thinking with Bojan back, they maybe can rise to the level of terrible and not abomination, disgrace to the game of basketball. Because a terrible team can beat you on a given night. Abomination, disgrace to the game of basketball probably has no chance of beating you because they're giving up in the first quarter.
I'm hoping that Bogdanovich helps as much as some people seem to think he is and or can, spacing wise, and hopefully he can get some. For Christ's sake, if you're Cade Cunningham, somebody please help me. I'm Leo drowning in the water right now, and Troy Weaver's sitting on the door, and he's just holding on to me, and he's saying, I'll never let go, Cade, but he's gonna let go.
You know what this reminds me of? This is a very special episode of Bad Boys and Beyond, and I am going to take a shot in your arena. This reminds me of the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air episode where Will Smith, it's the very special, well, they had a few of those, but this is the one that everyone remembers, where Will's father comes back after being absent. Wow. And at the very end, his father abandons him again, and he's hugging Uncle Phil saying, why doesn't he love me? And this is kind of like, this is kind of like the Uncle Phil is the Detroit, or the Will's father is the Detroit Pistons, and Will is the Pistons fan. And everyone's just, why don't the Pistons love me anymore? It kind of feels like that.
I watch that show once a year, every year, in the wintertime. All six seasons, I watch the episodes consecutively. And every time I watch that episode, I cry. Because it's always for a different reason, but for a lot of the times, it's just because this is probably the best acting I've ever seen.
It is.
On TV in my entire life. On a sitcom, Will just goes for it. That's like Oscar level. Like, it's incredible. And I'm just so mesmerized by the talent in that.
I watched that episode. Actually, I watched that episode live. Well, not live. Well, as it first aired.
Same.
And I can't ever watch it again.
It's a real
thing. I cannot watch it again. For me, it hits way too close to home for me to watch it again. Because he was crying and then I was crying. I'm like, I can't watch this again. I'm not going to do this to myself.
Will gets shot in the next season, And I find this harder to take than Will actually getting almost murdered in season five.
Well, because that was just corny. we're not going to go into it, but that was a corny episode.
Oh, yeah,
that the impact fell flat.
I get it. I get it. All right. Because I can talk Fresh Prince all day. Believe me, I had a podcast just based off Fresh Prince there for a while. Wasn't too successful. Apparently people don't love it like I love it. But all right, let's get into our topic today, which I didn't announce at the top of the show. I probably should have. If you're listening to this, we're going to be discussing former Pistons coach Doug Collins today.
Pistons coach and GM.
And GM, that's right. Yes, coach / GM, Doug Collins. Let's go all the way back to Christopher, Illinois. Here's an interesting thing that I don't know if you have in your notes. Doug Collins' next door neighbor is John Malkovich, and they grew up friends together.
Not in my notes.
There you go.
I was aware of that, but I was not planning to mention that. But that is a great tidbit. So yeah, Doug Collins, everyone remembers him as a coach, but he was a an excellent basketball player. Great size, 6'6", 2 guard. Did not do much else other than shoot, but he was great at shooting. Off the catch, off the dribble. I'm speaking like I've seen his entire college career. I haven't. I've seen a handful of his pro game. But no, Doug Collins could play when he was healthy. He could play. And he went to Illinois State, played for a guy named Will Robinson, who, after Collins graduated from Illinois State, would go on to spend the next 30 years of his life as a lead scout for the Detroit Pistons. Over 3 years, Doug Collins averaged over 29 points a game. Illinois State was never very good. I think they had just moved to Division I, his junior seat. Like, I don't think they were Division I the entire time. But Doug Collins was good enough where he got selected to play for the U.S. Olympic team in 1972.
Oh, boy.
And, yeah, we could do a whole episode on that, to be honest with you. Just the debacle that was that 72 Munich Olympics. And so, setting the stage, the basketball had been part of the Olympics since 1936. So in the 36 years preceding that, the USA had lost exactly zero basketball games, undefeated. Now, this was by far their most vulnerable Olympic team since they started. Bill Walton declined to participate. George Gervin, I don't think, was even considered. Same with David Thompson. They still had some good play, but they didn't have the elite college players of years past. And
that this is, in case you didn't know, this is before NBA players were eligible to play. So these are all college players.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. I'm older, so I just assume people know that, but you're right, I shouldn't assume that. And again, this is the 1970s. It's the heart of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union. So they meet in the gold medal game. It's one of the Soviet Union's better teams ever. And USA falls behind big early, and with no shot clock, it looks like they're in trouble. They make a comeback, and they get it down to a point with about 20 seconds left. And they force a turnover, and Doug Collins is ahead of everybody. Down by a point, and he goes in for a layup, and it's one of the uglier fouls you will ever see. The Soviet player doesn't even try to play the ball. He immediately goes for Doug Collins' legs while he's in the air and just sends Doug Collins like head over feet, just flying into the basket support. If that foul happened today, there would be police called. It doesn't look like much on camera until you see the result of it. I don't want to say it was a dirty play, because that's kind of how basketball was back then, especially when teams are desperate. You just hit the crap out of people because it was either a foul or an ejection, and referees generally didn't eject you unless you threw punches. So it looks like Doug Collins like may have broken his neck just by how he because you don't even see his head. He's just lying under the, like into the basket support. You don't even see his head. and they have to kind of lift him up off the floor. And just the concentration in Doug Collins' face, it's probably the only great moment in that game that the United States fans would take away, because he had just nearly gotten killed by this guy, trying to attempt a layup, and now he's got to attempt two free throws with 3 seconds left, with the United States down 1 to the Soviet Union. And he steps to the line, expressionless, no emotion whatsoever, and he swishes both of them. Those have been called the most pressure-packed free throws in the history of basketball, and that's very accurate, the amount of pressure that was on him, especially in the physical state that he was just in. And he makes both of those. Now, the end of the story is Soviet Union inbounds the ball. They throw it away, and the USA wins. And then they stop the game and give the Soviet Union another chance. And the Soviet Union throws up a half-court shot, misses. USA wins. And then they stop the game again. And on the third try, the Soviet Union scores a layup at the buzzer. And not one single person from that USA team has ever accepted a silver medal from that game. I understand why they kept resetting, but it still wasn't fair to the USA team. Not one person has ever accepted a silver medal from that game. In fact, some players have even put it into their will that their descendants may never accept a silver medal from that game. Every player on that team feels like they were robbed. And I feel bad for the Soviet team to this day, because it's not like they were the ones that kept giving themselves second chances. The Olympic Committee chairman, who had no business or no authority to do so, kept doing it, and they just allowed him to do it. But a lot of people got assassinated that weekend, so I'm not going to pretend it was even the biggest tragedy of the 72 Munich Olympics.
All right, so Doug Collins recovers from that, but look, he made a name for himself with those free throws. I'm sorry, Mike, you have
something? Yeah, I just wanted to quickly – I didn't realize I was on mute. I was talking that whole time. I want to quickly just recommend, if you want to see a little bit more on that Doug Collins moment, the Redeem Team documentary on Netflix is phenomenal. It's about the 2008 Team USA, and they actually sort of adopted Doug Collins almost as a mascot for that team. It's a really beautiful thing to watch. I would recommend watching that. Plus, Tayshaun Prince is in it.
So Doug Collins, and it is a good documentary. I've seen it. So Doug Collins enters the NBA draft in 1973. He's the top pick. Again, you look at it in hindsight, you know, he was one of the guys you look at and say, wow, he's one of the famous number one picks in recent memory. But if you look at the draft class that he was in, he is arguably the best player in that draft class. Now, George McGinnis was also in that draft, but keep in mind, George McGinnis, everybody knew he was going to the Indiana Pacers, who were in the ABA at that time, which is why he fell so far in the draft. In a 73 redraft, taking that into account, I think Doug Collins might go number one again. He was that good, and the draft class, quite frankly, wasn't very good.
So putting those two things together, he goes to the Sixers, who... much in the same state the Pistons are now. We're one of the historically worst teams in NBA history. But they got a lot better, a lot faster. You know, they picked up Collins. George McGinnis, once he left the Pacers, came over after the merger. They picked up Julius Erving after the merger. They almost put together kind of an all-star team. Daryl Dawkins, the guy we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, he comes in. And... you know, Doug Collins is still one of the leading scorers on that team, even with all those great players. They go to the finals in 1977. He is the top, even with George McGinnis on that team, he is still the second leading scorer behind Dr. J. Now, they blow that 1977 final, but Doug Collins makes four consecutive All-Star games. I think three or four. I can't remember which one. But, he's a perennial All-Star. Yeah, he is four. And it looks like he's going to be one of their fixtures in Philadelphia for a long time, and then he tears his ACL in his right knee in 1979. And then in 1980, he tears his ACL in his other knee.
And then he has a compound fracture in his foot. And I don't know if the foot injury necessarily would have ended his career, but the two ACLs at a time when ACLs were not very well taken care of essentially ended his career. He retired. He went from a four-time All-Star to being retired at 29. And that's how quickly it ended for Doug Collins. But he would he would have much brighter future in basketball ahead of him. Very, very, very introspective guy, very intelligent guy. One of the most fiery personalities you'll ever come across. That's why he keeps getting jobs in basketball. He's very engaging. Yeah, so Doug Collins, at a very young age, goes into coaching.
ASU.
Yep. He bounces around college, the college game, as an assistant for a little while. Never gets a head coaching job until the Chicago Bulls of all teams come calling. I'm assuming because of his NBA experience. They have just let go of another coach. Michael Jordan's going into his third season. And they think that he's a good match, and they were 100% right. Now, Doug Collins, I've been over his playing style, but this is his coaching style. He is a defensive genius, absolutely great at getting the most out of whatever team he's got defensively. He lives for that. Offensively, he's all about ball control, pace and space. But defense is always what he's hung his hat on. Not too dissimilar from Chuck Daly, just, you know, Chuck Daly on steroids, because, you know, he was always the emotional one, yelling and shouting, and Chuck Daly was a little more reserved.
I have a very good example of Doug Collins' coaching experience in Chicago, and I just wanted to share it with everybody real quick.
Okay.
Get the ball, Michael. Everybody get the out of the way.
There you go. That's Doug Collins in Chicago. Get the ball to Michael. Everybody get out of the way. That, of course, right after the big win over Cleveland. But you go ahead.
Okay, so Doug Collins takes over the Bulls in 1986-87. They were a 30, even though they made the playoffs the year before, famously, that was the year Jordan scored 63 points in the Boston Garden. The Bulls got swept anyway. They were a 30-win team. Now, to be fair, that's because Michael Jordan missed almost the entire season before the playoffs began. So you have to factor that in. But they were dead last in the NBA defensive efficiency in 1986. Dead last. The first season with the Chicago Bulls, with essentially the same roster, plus Michael Jordan, of course, that helps. But the first season, he took them from dead last to 11th, to a little bit above average. The season, and they went from 30 wins to 40 wins. You can say that, hey, Jordan's back. Of course, they're going to increase by a lot of wins, and they did. But the following season, 87-88, they increased from 40 to 50 wins, and they go from 11th in defensive efficiency to third. You cannot deny that improvement. And he was credited a lot with developing Scottie Pittman. Horace Grant, he was pretty steady right away as a rookie. He was buried behind Charles Oakley, but he had a comfortable spot in that rotation. Scottie Pippen he found himself out of the rotation at times early on with the, like, Doug Collins, I think, saw that Scottie Pippen could be special, and he brought him along very carefully because of that. And by playoff time, he was starting him after not starting him the entire season. I think that is one of the very underrated coaching jobs, stewarding along a young prospect, the job that Doug Collins did with Scottie Pippen in 87-88. So, unfortunately, for the Bulls anyway, they make the playoffs. They actually get out of the first round for the first time in forever since the 70s, and they run into the Bad Boys, and they get pounded out of the playoffs in five games. So everyone expects you increased by 10 wins each of the last 2 years. 89 might be the year where you can compete for a championship. And things kind of go to hell. The trade of Charles Oakley for Bill Cartwright, it freed up minutes for Horace Grant, but Horace wasn't necessarily ready for those minutes just yet. It was a good long-term move, not a good short-term move. And the Bulls got crushed by, they had two of the three best teams in the league in their division in Cleveland and Detroit. They went 0-for-12 combined against those two teams. So the Bulls took kind of a step back. And Doug Collins, I think this is maybe one of his weaknesses, is when things go badly, he leans extremely hard on his best player. In this case, it was Michael Jordan. He starts playing him at point guard, very reminiscent of the heliocentric offenses we see today, where it's like Luka Doncic doing everything. Well, he had Michael Jordan doing everything. Michael Jordan had, I think, 7 triple-doubles in 8 games or something like it towards the end of the season, just trying to keep the Bulls afloat. And it worked. And it worked even more in the playoffs when the Bulls got past Cleveland in the first round and then beat the Knicks in the second round, two of the top 3 seeds in the East. And then they ran into the Pistons, and the Pistons unleashed the Jordan rules. And even someone as great as Michael Jordan couldn't get past them when everybody in the building knew the ball was going to go through Michael Jordan on every possession. The other teams in the NBA didn't have an answer for it. The Pistons did. And look, that's where the clip that you just showed us, that audio clip came from, was the 89 conference finals, the last game that the Bulls won in that series, where Doug Collins is diagramming, or was asked to diagram his last play by the press in the post game. And he says, yeah, just get the ball to Michael, get everyone out of the way. And that was kind of to his detriment. Jordan liked it, of course, because Jordan was a control freak, just like Doug Collins, but it was hard to see the Bulls winning a championship that way. So even though they surpassed everybody's expectations, given they started the playoffs as a 6 seed by going to the conference finals, it wasn't good enough. And the Bulls moved on from Doug Collins and replaced him with one of his own assistants in Phil Jackson, who had a much more measured approach to dealing with the Jordan rules. And I think he was a better fit for that team to move them forward. Doug Collins was really, they would not have gotten off the ground if it weren't for Doug Collins. I truly believe that. But I think they reached their limit with him. And obviously, in hindsight, the decision to move on from him was correct.
Yeah, the only other thing that I would bring up is, the tremendous story on The Last Dance of Doug Collins' first NBA coaching experience, his first game, where he somehow managed to chew a piece of gum into powder. I just don't know how it's possible. And I chew gum a lot. I'm chewing gum right now. And I don't know how you could possibly do that. But
believe it or not, I've actually done that once before.
Really? You chewed gum into a powder?
Is, yes. When you've realized you chewed it that much. I'm not going to go into it, but it's possible. I've experienced it, and it is the nastiest feeling ever. Like, as soon as you realize what you're like chewing powder, you just spit it out. Like, it's disgusting.
Yeah. Well, and then, obviously how Michael said, wipe that stuff off your face, and I'm not going to let you lose your first game. And that was just the power of Michael Jordan.
Jordan and Doug Collins were very much alike personality-wise. They were both obsessive jerks. Unfortunately, I don't think being there's only room for one obsessive jerk on a team at one time, I think.
So, as you had mentioned, Collins is let go in 1989, and then he becomes a TV guy. He does a lot of broadcasting, and I think he was doing stuff with NBC and a few other places.
NBC and TNT.
And TNT, yep. And then in 1995, an opportunity comes up.
Yeah, so Doug Collins, he has the luxury of taking a few years off, taking it easy. He goes into television, which Doug Collins is one of the best TV analysts in the history of the NBA, mainly because his son Chris is going to college. He went to Duke. He actually played for Mike Krzyzewski in the early 90s. So Doug spent a lot of time at Duke games watching not only his son, but the other players on the Duke team, one of which was named Grant Hill, which we'll get into later. And so the Pistons are finishing up Grant Hill's rookie season, 1995, at home against the Orlando Magic. So a week or two left in the season. They're going nowhere. They're kind of a they're a young team with some veterans that don't fit, but they do have a couple of a few young stars in Allen Houston, Grant Hill, Lindsey Hunter, and they go up against the Magic, who were the number one seed in the East that season, and they just light them up on national TV. He was working for TNT that night. And you can almost hear the gears turn in Doug Collins' head as he's calling this game. He's getting more and more interested in the Detroit Pistons as he's watching this game, the young nucleus that they have. And before the offseason even begins, before the finals end that season, the Pistons, they fire their GM, they fire their coach. Jack McKinney's the GM, and their coach was Don Chaney. And they have two vacancies. Now, Doug Collins is still a big name at this point. He's in no rush to get back into the NBA. He has plenty of options always at all times because he has a great reputation at this point. So the only way that Bill Davidson can really sway him is by offering him full team control. What does that mean? That means you coach the team and you get final say over personnel, essentially making you the de facto GM. Now, obviously, he can't make calls to other teams and coach the team at the same time. That's not how the coach GM job has ever worked. You have a guy that makes those calls, but he has final say over personnel. He can say, go get this guy, or I don't like this deal. I'm going to veto it. He had that full authority over who was playing for him. So what's the first thing that Doug Collins does as GM in that offseason? It is one of the very few trades where I've ever seen a team trade out of the lottery and get the better end of the deal. He has the number 8 pick in the 1995 draft. He actually trades down with the Portland Trail Blazers for what ends up being the 18th pick, the 58th pick, which is the last pick in that year's draft, plus Otis Thorpe, who had just been traded to Portland for Clyde Drexler. Now, what does he do with those picks? He gets Theo Ratliff with the number 18 pick, and with the number 58 pick, the very last pick in the draft, never accused Doug Collins of wasting draft picks. He gets Don Reed. And Don Reed, for those of you that don't know, winds up starting 137 games with the Detroit Pistons over the next few seasons. He actually starts more than twice as many games as Theo Ratliff does. And yeah, that's kind of one of the few good things about Doug Collins is that he knew the types of players that he wanted in the draft. And he usually got good players, or at least players that he could get a lot out of. So, you know, that move being done, that's kind of his offseason.
Right. So the Pistons,
they start the 95-96 season. There's a lot of hype around that team. They've added Otis Thorpe. They've added some young pieces. The young pieces they have are now a year older. They're expected to move forward, and the team kind of falls flat. They start 0-3. They're kind of bailed out by Theo Ratliff, of all people, in the fourth game. He has this – I remember this to this day. I wish I could. I'm sorry.
Really quick. Bojan's not playing tonight. Okay, carry on.
Okay, well, they hyped everyone up for nothing then. Okay. Yep. So, long story short, they start slowly because Doug is not a fan of Allen Houston's defense, and Allen has trouble getting on the court, and the Pistons are struggling because they have trouble scoring. So they start out 0-3. They do get that first win against Portland. They win the next three, but then they lose their next three after that, dropping them to 3-6. And then ultimately, that bottoms out at 5-9 before Allen Houston starts getting real playing time. And this is kind of the problem, even though this team gets better as the season goes along. They win 46 games. They go 46-36. They actually have a very good season. And they go from being, again, this is a pattern with Doug Collins' coach teams. They were dead last in the NBA in defensive efficiency, Grant Hill's rookie year. In the year following that, they were seventh. They were that good defensively for a team that really didn't even have a center. Otis Thorpe, who was a power forward by trade, was starting at center for him for a long time. And The issue with that team, unfortunately, that people couldn't see because the team was winning, was he had this musical chairs rotation at guard with Allen Houston, Lindsey Hunter, and Joe Dumars. Two very young prospects that needed time, and an aging veteran who was the captain of the team, who he really couldn't risk upsetting. So the season starts out with Allen Houston being the one left out. And then as the season moves on, Joe Dumars is coming off the bench midseason, which really upset him. And he made that known to everybody that he wasn't happy coming off the bench. And by the end of the season, it became Allen Houston and Dumars in the starting backcourt, and Lindsey Hunter barely playing. And Lindsey Hunter at a certain point in that season wanted off the team because then he wasn't playing. It was this weird thing where Collins actually had good players, but he couldn't figure out how to make them happy. And furthermore, I don't think he cared. It's not that he was callous. That's one of his flaws, I think, was Doug was such a basketball mind. I don't think he ever paid enough attention to the human aspect of coaching a team, which as a head coach in the NBA, you absolutely have to be able to manage personalities, manage egos. Doug really never cared for that. He was interested in X's and O's and, you know, what strategies do I use to beat team B? And that comes back to bite him by the end of the season, even though by all accounts, the Pistons had a fantastic year from where they were, 10 games above 500. They got swept in the first round by the Magic, but that Magic team was a powerhouse, and the Pistons very easily could have taken that last game, that game three at the Palace, and they kind of got screwed over by a referee call. But everyone's saying, hey, Pistons are on their way up. We've got this young nucleus. We've got a great mix of veterans. Everyone in this team fits together. 96-97 is going to maybe not our year, but this is going to be the year where we're up there right next to the Bulls as the next dominant team in the East. And the summer of 1996 happens.
Yeah. The worst summer in Pistons history. I mean, it has to be. Almost
as bad I always as 2023. Say, and look, it's the worst summer because that team had the potential to be very, very good.
Mutombo.
They had the potential to be a contender in the Eastern Conference. I doubt they could have beaten the Bulls, but they could have been right up there as like a 60-win team, challenging them and positioning themselves to take over when the Bulls finally broke up. So problem number one, Doug Collins' relationship with Allen Houston is essentially ruined at this point. Allen Houston is an unrestricted free agent, and Doug Collins does not, or at least his management team does not, tender their best offer to Allen Houston. I don't know what offer was sent, but it was definitely not their best that they could have done. Because as soon as he walked out the door, the New York Knicks did give their best offer to Allen Houston, and he signed with them almost immediately, without even giving the Pistons a chance to match. Mentally, I think he was already gone, but I think there was still a chance for Doug to save him, to save that relationship, if he had at least showed him the money and showed him that he was appreciated and valued. And instead, they tried to play the penny-pinching, you know, we can't pay you more than Grant Hill. Well, even Grant Hill disagreed with that, to be honest with you, because he was still on his rookie deal. But they didn't, and that was the first domino of several to fall. When Allen Houston left, Juwan Howard, who they were pursuing, he broke off talks and went back to Washington for $100 million, which he wasn't worth. But he certainly would have made the Pistons a little better. And the other domino, which to me was the biggest one, this is the one that would have put them over the top, Dikembe Mutombo, who was an unrestricted free agent. He famously took the exact offer that the Pistons tendered to him, and he handed it to the Atlanta Hawks and said, if you can match this, I will sign here. He signed with the Atlanta Hawks for the exact same offer the Pistons gave him, because... And look, he said it was because of the weather, which, fine, he's used to the warmer weather. But the bottom line is he was not the word out on Doug Collins was he was hard to play for, and free agents did not want to hear that, signing a long-term deal with any NBA team. So I think Doug Collins kind of chased away his own best chance for success there.
The weather, huh? The weather in Philadelphia was okay. Didn't mind that.
Well, he was traded to Philadelphia.
Or New Jersey or New York. Guy spent most of his career in cold weather.
Yeah, but, well, he did. But he was drafted by Denver, and then he was traded to Philadelphia. And, you know, by the time we're talking New York, New Jersey, he's in his 40s. So he doesn't really have that many options left.
That's fine.
Look, again, I think if Allen Houston were still a Detroit Piston, I think Mutombo probably would have signed there. But it's just he was – and that was with every free agent the Pistons looked into. It's just, you know, everything we're hearing about Doug Collins is that you don't want to play for him, which is unfair, and it's sad because as a coach, he was really, really smart.
So – and this isn't the worst part about that offseason. So Doug Collins panics. He sends two first rounders to the Hawks for Stacey Augmon and Grant Long just to find some warm bodies to fill the holes in his rotation. Two first round picks for Stacey Augmon, who never even sniffed an all-star game in his life, and Grant Long, who you see on Valley Sports Detroit every other night, giving you three reasons why the Detroit Pistons could have avoided this 75-point loss to the LA Clippers.
He's really good at it. I mean, he's really great at it.
I never know because League Pass cuts out before he ever gets to that part, so I will take your word for it.
Grant Long's a great guy. Great guy. We love – this is a pro-Grant Long podcast.
It is, but he was also a good ninth or tenth man on a really good team, which is ironic because he comes back to the Pistons later after the Pistons trade him and beats him in a playoff game. All right, so all of that damage being done, the Pistons are kind of looked at as a team that's falling apart. In one offseason, the perception of them changes, and this is, I think, where you see the best of Doug Collins because he is so competitive, he is so angry, and sets out to prove himself that they can still win. So... I brought this up before. He watched his son Chris play with Grant Hill, Grant Hill's senior year, when Mike Krzyzewski, but this was the year after they lost Bobby Hurley to the NBA, and they really didn't have a point guard. So Mike Krzyzewski had Grant Hill playing point guard his senior year at Duke, and he played it extremely well. So Doug Collins knew from experience that Grant Hill could be a point guard if he really had to. So that's exactly what he does. He starts Lindsey Hunter at Joe Dumars at guard, and he essentially puts the ball in Grant Hill's hands, has him walk the ball up, has him initiate the offense. And it works out hilariously well. You have Terry Mills putting in his best season of his career, spacing the floor. This was, despite being one of the slowest-paced teams in the history of the shot clock era, Doug Collins carefully crafted just about every play for that team. Anytime the other team made a run or made an adjustment, he would call a timeout and he would make his own adjustment. He absolutely refused to let that team give anything but their best. And a collection of guys that around Grant Hill that didn't really impress anybody started the season. 10-1. He started that season. They run that up to 20-4. They and the Bulls were on the same exact win pace for a very long time for the first quarter of the season. They run that up to 30-11, which at that point was the best first half of the season record in Pistons history. And their high point for that season is 33-11. 33-11 for a team whose starting five was, I believe, Grant Hill alongside Otis Thorpe, Terry Mills, Lindsey Hunter, and Joe Dumars. Just incredible. And Dumars and Terry Mills were two of, I think, the three most accurate three-point shooters in the league that season. So Grant Hill had all the spacing he wanted to work with and a pick-and-roll finisher extraordinaire in Otis Thorpe.
That's the year Terry was in the three-point competition, if I'm not mistaken.
He was, and yep. He finished horribly because he was not in the physical shape to shoot 33-pointers in like 30 seconds.
Right.
God bless Terry. He earned that spot in the contest, but there was no way he was going to win it.
And so this is the point where, all right, so I said that this season was the best of Doug Collins, and it was. I don't think any other coach in the NBA on planet Earth could have gotten 33-11 out of that team. And now we go into the second half of the season, which was arguably the worst job of Doug Collins' career. So I mentioned the Pistons are 33-11 at their high point. It's 44 games in. Game 45 was a home game against Phoenix, who was not very good, but they were surging at that point. They had started the year 0-10. But they actually made the playoffs. They made a bunch of trades. They got Jason Kidd. It's a whole thing. Don't worry about it. We're going to move on. But this is a team the Pistons should have beaten. And the Pistons are kind of having this sluggish. They're not getting back on defense well enough. Mark Bryan is hitting a bunch of shots, a career journeyman. It was just one of those games where you write off as a schedule loss where the other team got hot and you just didn't have it that night. This is what 99 out of 100 coaches would do. Doug Collins is not one of those coaches. Doug Collins is just ripping into his team after every timeout. What are you doing? We're blowing this game. And he starts yelling at them to play more defense. And Otis Thorpe, very imposing human being, also well known as kind of having more of a sensitive side, was not used to being screamed at by his NBA coaches. He never had a screamer as a coach prior to Doug Collins. So he starts snapping back at him. Are you going to go out and play defense? And their relationship was kind of ruined at that point because he had enough. And the Pistons lose that game. And they go on a bit of a losing streak. Well, that's kind of harsh. They finished the season, I want to say 21-16 they finished the season. From 33-11 to 21-16. And it gets to a point where Otis Thorpe is simply turning his back on Doug Collins during timeouts and refusing to acknowledge that he's even standing there giving instructions. And it kind of ripped the entire team apart. That great chemistry that they had the first half of the season just completely disintegrates. And they go from the number 2 seed in the East to the 3rd seed to the 4th seed. They drop all the way down to the 6th seed at one point before recovering. And this is one of those sad moments where the Pistons, after losing to the Bulls every year for 4 years, just getting trounced by them, it's towards the end of the season. The Bulls are going for 70 wins again. And the Pistons play inspired ball. They're trying to save their playoff positioning. And they just beat the hell out of the Chicago Bulls. They just absolutely beat the crap out of them on NBC. And you see Doug Collins crying towards the end of the game because he thinks his team is playing for them, for him. And they really aren't. They're playing for themselves and their playoff positioning, and because they want to beat the Bulls. And there were rumors that Doug Collins was going to be fired before the playoffs began because the relationship he had with his team had deteriorated that badly. Incredible for a team that started 20-4, and the coach is almost fired before the season even ends. That's kind of how his personality really grated on the rest of his team. And it was everybody. It wasn't just Otis Thorpe. Otis was simply the guy that couldn't handle it or that handled it the least or the worst, I guess you could say. So the Pistons managed 54 wins after all that. I imagine a nightmare season where you win 54 games, right? You know, we should be so unfortunate now.
So they match up with the Atlanta Hawks, a team that they should have absolutely beaten. Their best player was Dikembe Mutombo or Steve Smith. Take your pick. Neither of them ever approached the level of dominance that Grant Hill had. And the Pistons win 2 out of their first 3 games. It's a best of 5, so you only have to win 3. They go to game 4, and Doug Collins is so scared that Hawks coach Lenny Wilkins is going to throw a wrinkle at the Pistons in a desperation must-win game 4 that he sabotages his own team. he completely scraps the high pick and roll stuff and starts them. He starts installing like a motion based triangle offense for game. It's really weird. And he's outsmarting himself. He's trying to show the Hawks something that they won't expect, but he's doing that to his own team. His own team wasn't expecting this. So they, you know, they practice it once and they go out and they score 82 points total in game four at the Palace and they blow the game. I don't think they ever even had a lead. The Hawks controlled that game throughout. And he had so many chances to save himself, Doug Collins did this season. He kept getting into his own way. It's his own obsessive, his own obsession with winning, I guess you could say, or with competing. When Michael Jordan can get away with that, he's a world-class basketball athlete. Doug Collins as a coach cannot. He has to make people happy. So the Pistons go into Atlanta, and this is kind of the final straw with Otis Thorpe just has to stick the final nail in, where they're going into halftime. The game is still close, and Doug Collins is telling his team, just keep this game close going into the fourth quarter. I will find a way for us to win this game. And Otis Thorpe shouts at him, what are you going to do? Are you going to get out and play? And again, a must-win, winner-take-all playoff game, and his players are still fighting him. And they go out into the second half. They give it a great effort, but they just don't have the chemistry. They don't have – everything is just a little bit off, and that was – a little bit off was enough for Atlanta to win that series. It was a very painful series to watch, especially at the time as a young Pistons fan, because you knew that the Pistons were kind of beating themselves. The Hawks weren't a bad team at all, but the Pistons should have won that, and they didn't. And that heads us into the offseason of 97, where Doug Collins tries to play damage control.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Well, he does do one great thing. He sends Otis Thorpe off, as everyone knew he would do.
Right.
To the Vancouver Grizzlies for a future number one pick, highly protected, but
that didn't turn out to be a great thing.
No, the fact that the Grizzlies sent him a first round pick for a guy that everybody knew he had to get off of his team, just mind blowing. Stu Jackson, right now the only GM with a 4-year GM tenure with a lower winning percentage than Troy Weaver. That's all you need to know. So
you got to give Stu some, just a tiny bit of.
I do not.
Because this is an expansion team that we're talking about.
Yeah, so we're the Raptors. And the Raptors were in the playoffs in year five.
Yeah, they got Damon Stoudemire.
The Grizzlies first made the playoffs in year like 11.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair.
All right. So, and not only that, like he had chances to draft guys. All right. We're moving on.
Yeah.
All right. So. Now Doug Collins has a problem because he's traded his biggest interior presence. He needs to replace him with somebody, and there's really no one on the free agent market that he can get. So he goes after Brian Williams, later known as Bison Dele, Pistons fans would probably remember him by, who had, you know, just rode Jordan's coattails after being released, I think, by the Magic or the Clippers. I think it was the Clippers. He didn't even have a team prior to joining the Bulls for the playoff run, for their 1997 playoff run. And he actually plays, to his credit, he played pretty well. We covered Brian Williams / Bison Dele in his own episode. You can look it up. It's a very good one.
Yes.
So I'm not going to get too much into it. But the point is, he did not show anything. he did not show anything to... make anyone believe that he deserved to be a foundation piece for an NBA team. He was a talented player that you couldn't rely on. Everybody knew that. And Doug Collins, so desperate to save his job that he throws him a gigantic amount of money. And he also signs Malik Sealy, which was a value signing on a 1-year deal. And that was the extent of his offseason. And unfortunately, Malik Sealy, very, very too similar to Grant Hill, where neither of them was a very good outside shooter, but so you'd have a lot of Grant drives into the lane, draws three defenders, kicks it out to Malik Sealy, who drives into the lane, draws three defenders, kicks it out to Grant Hill. Malik Sealy, rest in peace, a very good NBA player, just a very terrible fit on that team, and Doug probably should have seen that coming. Meanwhile, Bison Dele, who I'll call him from now on, he called it – Bison Dele termed Doug Collins' coaching style joyless basketball. And if to an extent it kind of was, but Bison was also the guy that was loafing on defense. Bison was also the guy that was showing up very unmotivated to play every other night. Bison was not the guy that had any credibility to be saying this about the coach when his teammates probably disliked him more than they disliked their coach. Rest in peace, Bison Dele. But here's the point. Doug Collins has essentially alienated everybody at this point. He's broken up a team that had great chemistry. He's ran players off. He's ran Allen Houston off, ran Otis Thorpe off. And it gets to a point where he is now screaming at Joe Dumars for not playing defense. And Joe, look, to be fair to Doug, Joe was a little out of shape at that point in his career. He was older. He was kind of taking it easy on defense. He wasn't the all-defensive guy he used to be. And Doug just couldn't get it through his head to manage that instead of demanding more from him, because no coach ever screamed at Joe Dumars. He had that level of respect. And when he started doing that, it was like you're screaming at a guy who has a direct line to the owner of the team. This is probably – Doug probably should have started thinking about quitting at that point, even though that's not in his DNA to quit. He had to have known that there was no way getting out of it. No one on the team stuck up for him at that point. Joe Dumars, Grant Hill, the rest of them, they were all ready to move on. And Doug Collins does make one last move as coach GM. He sends Theo Ratliff and Aaron McKee to Philadelphia for one Jerry Stackhouse, which is probably the best trade that he made, ironically. Unfortunately, you know, the team is in such a hole at that point. They're well out of the playoffs. They play about 500 ball for the next 20 games, but it all comes to a head on national TV. Wait till you hear this. A national TV game at home against the Washington Wizards. the hapless Washington Wizards, where the Pistons get embarrassed. They look lifeless, and they get blown out. And the very next day, Doug Collins gets fired. Things come full circle.
There you go. And yeah, you know, he's not done coaching though. Obviously he's going to go coach for the Michael Jordan and Charles Oakley. He's going to coach them again in Washington.
And I just want to add, I would just like to add this, even with his team in full revolt and essentially tuning him out, the Pistons in Doug Collins' final season were a top 10 defensive team still. He was still getting the very best out of them defensively. It's just offensively, they had no spacing. They didn't play well together. They had poor chemistry. And it's, I don't think they tried to lose games or anything. It was just he had driven so many good players out, and he had replaced them with players that were either not as good or were just simply bad fits. And that was kind of what ended Grant Hill's best chance for a contending team in Detroit.
Well, really anywhere. Phoenix, I guess, would be would count as a contending team.
Grant Hill, we've had the Grant Hill episode, but you know, he had a great great twilight to his career with Phoenix.
Yeah,
nearly to the finals. And so like as you said, he goes to coach Michael Jordan, who is essentially owner / player, even though that technically wasn't true for the Wizards. He personally asked Doug Collins to come coach him for his final 2 years with the Wizards. That's the level of respect that Michael Jordan had for Doug Collins. Of all the coaches in the league, other than Phil Jackson, who wasn't available, Doug Collins was the guy that Jordan called up. That was the level of respect there. That's how much he respected Collins' ability to coach a team. And look, those Wizards teams weren't very good, but they were also injuries just crushed them. Injuries to Rip Hamilton and Michael Jordan in the first season, and then injuries to, I think, Jerry Stackhouse missed some time in the second season. They weren't very good to begin with, but I thought he got a lot out of them when they were healthy.
And everyone thinks that, you know, when Jordan retires from the Wizards and Collins leaves with him, that's it, that Doug Collins is done with the NBA. Everyone thinks that. And then about 10 years later, he comes back with a vengeance for the team that drafted him, the Philadelphia 76ers. And what's the pattern that I keep emphasizing with Doug Collins when he takes over a team? They get better defensively.
Yeah, right? They get better defensively, right. Sorry.
Sixers were 24th in the league in defensive efficiency when Doug Collins took over. His first season, they were 7th. His second season, they were 3rd.
And this is a team without any real defensive stalwarts. He was just really, really good at diagramming a half-court defense. And they ran into a bit of luck, but they did come within one game of reaching the conference finals in his second season. Third season, they kind of fell apart, but I think the point was made to everybody. I think that was a great way for Doug Collins to have his send-off. Those early 2010 Sixers teams, before they decided to go full process, were, I think they were an excellent reflection of who Collins was as a coach. He I think, is very underrated because I think he's offended a lot of his former players. So you don't hear a lot of guys speaking about him, but anytime you see him on TV doing a playoff game, I don't know if he still does TV. I don't think, maybe he does.
No, he currently works for the Bulls, which we'll get to here in a moment, but finished second in coaching of the year votes that year. I mean, like, he was,
yeah, the Sixers of the year. Did not have a great team at all. And yeah, everywhere Doug Collins has been, it's pretty much been the same thing. He's one of the smartest basketball minds I have personally ever heard. But he also kind of he didn't have that player management knack. He just couldn't do what Chuck Daly did and manage personalities, manage egos, even though he was probably a far more intelligent X's and O's guy than Chuck Daly was.
And yeah, and he's actually going to not coach very much longer. He's actually going to resign in 2013. He's going to walk away from coaching to spend time with his grandkids. And I guess he stayed on as an advisor, but that's actually what he's doing now with the Bulls. He's been with them since 2017 as a senior advisor of basketball operations. I don't know what the senior advisor of basketball operations does, but
I have no idea. When you say that, that sounds like one of those jobs that you pass down to like your nephew or something.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, Collins is probably never going to coach again, and that's fine.
He's getting into his 70s now, I doubt
it. But despite what happened with the Pistons, I think it's fair to say that he has a pretty decent lineage in basketball.
I mean, oh, yeah.
A good legacy as a player, and he was a good coach. He just, you know, sometimes would overthink things or he would just be in the wrong situation, but...
Phil Jackson was his lead assistant. Like, everyone understand, that's how Phil Jackson got his start, or his big break in the NBA was as Doug Collins' lead assistant. I mean, Doug Collins saw that Phil Jackson had good coaching qualities.
Yeah, so he certainly had an eye for talent. But yeah, you know, an interesting thing that I wanted to bring up a little bit earlier. You mentioned his son, Chris Collins, who is currently the head coach for Northwestern.
Northwestern, yeah.
Yeah. But also
very much like his father, by the way, if you ever watch a Northwestern game. Extremely intense.
And looks exactly like him, too. Like he looks really exactly like what Doug looked like when he coached the Pistons. It's unbelievable. But also, Chris Collins coached for a Detroit basketball team for a little bit. He was the assistant coach, Nancy Lieberman's assistant coach for the Detroit Shock.
Yeah. That's a good pull, Mike. I'm proud
runs,
of you.
Runs in the family. Collins in Detroit. They love it here. But yeah, that's all we've got for Doug Collins. Well, actually, you know, like, what the hell? Could Doug Collins coach today? I mean, I know he's 70. He's not going to want to, but could he theoretically coach today?
You know, it's easy to say no, except for the fact that he was a very successful coach 10 or 11 years ago. I think maybe the biggest difference between then and now is social media as far as managing personalities and players and egos. But the X's and O's, look, he's coached the NBA in several different generations and several different styles of play were dominant. I see no reason why he wouldn't be able to figure out how to stop people in 2023. I think the same result would probably happen. His players would probably burn out on him after a year or two, but the personality, like I almost wish I could see Doug Collins coach today. Just because I was always fascinated by the little wrinkles he would come up with. His out of timeout stuff, his out of bounds plays, they were just like chef's kiss, just awesome. And no two were alike. I'm going to throw this one out there because it happened on my 15th birthday. It's one of my favorite Pistons games of all time. The Pistons were down by 2 points with a fraction of a second left. And they were inbounding the ball at near midcourt. And he has Grant Hill throw a lob pass to Lindsey Hunter. Grant Hill, who should, everyone's thinking he's the guy that's going to be catching the, no. He has him throw the lob pass out of bounds to Lindsey Hunter, who is the shortest player on the court. And it works to perfection. And Lindsey Hunter flips the ball in. He taps the ball in over his head to tie the game, to send it in overtime, and the Pistons win. But look, he had so many great plays like that I probably can't even remember. Just the genius plays that he would draw up. I wish I could see him coach today, even though it seems like he was always doomed to end up in, I don't want to say failure because that's too harsh, but I would say disaster maybe.
Yeah, it's I would just like to see what he could do with teams defensively, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is what it is. Well, that is going to wrap up today's episode. Obviously, you know, we spent a lot more time talking about the current Pistons than we normally do. And maybe next Wednesday when we come back, maybe we'll have something good to talk about with that. But
Not likely, given the subject matter. Yeah. Not likely.
Seems unlikely, yeah. There's two games in between now and the next time we'll see you guys.
And so, what is our subject next week, Mike?
Next week we are doing the, get ready for it, because we are doing the 2020 NBA draft. Yes, that is the Killian Hayes draft, everyone's favorite. We're going to... Go ahead.
You know, and I'm going to announce this right now. Troy Weaver, I believe, had picks, what, 7, 16, and 19?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to do the top 19 at a minimum.
All right, we're going deep. We're going deep, and we have a guest.
We will do the top 18, both of us and our featured guest, and then we're all going to come to a consensus on who the 19th pick should have been.
Sounds like a plan. Our guest... for this one will be none other than Bryce Simon, Motor City Hoops himself, co-host of the Pistons Pulse. Very excited to have Bryce back. Maybe we can get him to bring Amari with him. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. This is going to be a fun episode. I'm really looking forward to rewriting recent Pistons history and hopefully coming out with something a lot better. Killian Hayes is not going to be drafted by the Pistons in this one.
Maybe he will be at 90. We don't know yet because it was not a very strong draft class. We do not know who will be available at 19.
I'll tell you what, Tyrese Halliburton isn't making it nearly as deep as he did in the actual draft. And let me just say, you know, finding out over the weekend I'm a big wrestling fan, huge pro wrestling fan. Finding out over the weekend that Tyrese Halliburton is a pro wrestling fan, a huge one like myself, made it just sting a little bit more that Troy had three chances to take him and didn't do it, or at least two.
He had one chance to take Halliburton.
I thought he could have taken him with that second pick. Halliburton went late, like 18 or 19, didn't he?
No, he didn't. No. Halliburton went like 11th, I think.
Either way, but
he didn't drop that far.
Fine. He you know what I'm saying. He at least had one shot to take him, and he didn't. And everybody thought that was the way they were going, and it wasn't the way they wound up going. But anyways, we'll see you guys next week. Where does Killian Hayes wind up?